Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box podcast. Carol Walker sitting in for Matt Chorley. On today's episode, we're talking about populism with the politics guru, Professor Tim Bale, whose book Riding the Populist Wave is out now. But first, it's time for our columnists. It's Monday, so it must be Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. You can either tell me what your favourite song for getting on the dance floor is, or you can give me a suggestion for one of our politicians. Libby, are you known to take to the dance floor?
Not really, because my husband doesn't like dancing. But if he's not looking and he's not there, I am going to a 60s disco in aid of our local hospital next month. And I plan to really knock it out to, I don't know, obla-dee, obla-da. Who knows?
Perfect. Rachel, what about you?
Well, I love We Are Family, and I'm always, that's the only thing that gets me on the dance floor when it's sort of like a big family event. But for our politicians, I thought you could have Boris Johnson and Common People, because he's pretending to be a man of the people, and actually, I really don't think he is.
Oh, excellent. And segueing into our big thing at 11 o'clock, we're going to be talking all about populists and populism with Professor Tim Bale. Good to have you both with us. Dominic Raab, a lot of pressure on him again today. The Times reporting over the weekend how there was a massive blame game going on within government. Today there's a big meeting of the G7 to try to somehow coordinate how the biggest powers are going to deal with this future Taliban government. Libby, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's time we all moved on from Raab's holiday and whether or not the sea was closed. I think we are going to have to acknowledge the Taliban. We may detest their regime, their attitude to women, their criminal justice, but we are constantly dealing with other brutal and misogynistic countries, not least Saudi Arabia. We always have. The other night on Times Radio, actually, we were talking about Paul Kenyon's marvellous book on Romania and looking at pictures of the Queen sitting next to Ceausescu at a time when the Romanians were under the cosh in a mad regime, and Ceausescu was still taking money to release Jews to Israel for ransom. I mean, international diplomacy has to work that way. If the Taliban prove able to keep order and to prevent terrorist plans on their turf and maintain reasonable conditions along their borders, I think we have to acknowledge them. There's no point sort of virtue signalling and holding our nose. Wouldn't work.
Rachel, what do you think on this?
I think Libby's right, although it has to be sort of deeds rather than words. You know, all of this, we're going to, you know, recognise women's rights under Islamic law, etc. That sounds a bit dodgy to me. But Libby's right. In the end, diplomacy is about, you know, what's in the national interest and protecting. If you can, you know, thwart some terrorist attacks by keeping links with the Taliban, that's one thing. But I do think maybe Libby's letting Dominic Raab off a bit lightly. I think you're right, Libby, that we've got to move on from the paddleboarding and the holiday and all of that. But for me, it wasn't the issues what happened over that weekend. It's the fact that for months he wasn't making the calls he should have done. He wasn't preparing. He wasn't focusing on Afghanistan.
True,
we've
yes.
known mm. since April. I don't care really where he was on holiday or, you know, but he should have been making calls to Pakistan for weeks or months. He should have been preparing for the evacuation, making sure the interpreters had a way out way before that weekend when he was on the paddleboard or wasn't on the paddleboard. And that really is, I think that's a sort of wider problem for the government, that they're distracted. They saw foreign policy only in terms of Brexit, and but there's no sort of vision of what global Britain is or where, you know, who our allies now are. What is the position on Afghanistan? They just didn't have a wider view of it. And that, I think, is a problem for Rob and for Boris Johnson and the whole government, actually.
Yeah, and we heard in the Times over the weekend that Rob had apparently not even spoken to his Afghan and Pakistan counterparts for some 6 months, Libby, when, I mean, we knew the timetable for the withdrawal.
No, Rachel's right. I mean, there's been an enormous sort of shortage of forward thinking on that. And I think an underestimate of the Taliban. I think they sort of thought, righto, Western powers, we've put in this government in Afghanistan, you know, they can cope. And it's just been apparently to close watchers apparent that they couldn't cope for a very long time. So, yes, I mean, I think the damn distraction of Brexit has been the worst bit of it. It may in the end prove to have been a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but as a distraction, you know, the combination of Brexit and COVID. But he was the foreign secretary. He is the foreign secretary. The foreign secretary is supposed to be looking widely at the whole world.
Yeah, I mean, Rachel, you, yeah, very close watcher and lots of good contacts in politics. We're hearing some, of course, unnamed source saying that Raab is toast. What do you think?
Well, the problem is if Boris Johnson gets rid of him, he's got to have somebody else in that role. And it's this really the decision for Boris Johnson now is he going to have a cabinet of the best people available to him to do those jobs? Or is it going to be still the cabinet of, you know, stooges and Brexit loyalists who will do what he says? And so far, he's chosen the sort of stooges rather than the most talented. I mean, there are so many people on the back benches in the Tory party, let alone people who've been thrown out of the Tory benches. You know, it's sort of shameful, really. I mean, I interviewed Rory Stewart a couple of weeks ago when this was all really falling apart in Afghanistan. And he's so knowledgeable and impressive. He's no longer even in the House of Commons. He said he couldn't see a way back to being an MP, although he'd love to, you know, serve the public in some way or another. And that's a real shame. So whether or not Dominic Raab himself survives, I think probably it'll be to do with whether Boris Johnson thinks he can afford to sack him. It's more about Boris Johnson, sadly, and his kind of confidence in his own position than the country.
Libby, you've got a column in the Times this morning going back to the Monica Lewinsky scandal 23 years ago. Tell us about that.
Well, it's because there's a television series which she's collaborating strongly with about the whole affair. And I thought, let's look back, because I admire the way that Monica Lewinsky has been in the last 6 years, particularly in her wonderful TED talk, which is now taught in some schools, about shaming and cyberbullying and attitudes to victims, male as well as female. So I thought, let's look back at the way she was seen, the way she was treated, while Clinton and Hillary rode on regardless in the end after that scandal. And that
it was Remind some of our younger listeners that, of course, she was reported to have had an affair with the president, wasn't she?
Absolutely, an affair which he denied, and then it was proven by various things, not least a stain on a certain blue dress and so on, and Clinton's saying, "I did not have sex with that woman." And in fact, one of the lawyerly sort of defences of that was that she was doing all the work. I need not draw you pictures. It's a family show. It's a bank holiday. But anyway, she was absolutely monstered in every direction and hugely humiliated. And she became an international joke. And even people who you'd have thought would have been decent about her, you know, like Erica Jong and Nancy Friday, you know, they kind of added in the jeering about blowjobs and so on. But what I wanted to do is to reflect that these days, after Weinstein and Epstein and the Me Too campaign and Time's Up, we are actually harder on men in these cases and less prone to label women as just wicked temptress trollops and it was all her fault she tempted him. If you want to see some fairly disgusting views about men and women and affairs and blame, today, just look among some of the comments under the piece in the Times. You know, these miserable old dinosaurs who hate women have not quite gone away yet. But it's just interesting to reflect on this. But I would advise anyone younger who doesn't know about the scandal actually to read the column, because I do run through it quickly and explain what happened and how she was treated.
Yeah, and it is fascinating, though, how somebody who, as you say, was treated with such opprobrium at the time and has managed to rebuild her life. Rachel?
I think it's such an interesting column from Libby, and it reminded me also, you know, even Nigella Lawson has abandoned the word slut from one of her favourite red raspberry puddings. And there has been a sort of change of attitude and priorities. And sometimes I think people criticise the Me Too movement. They say, oh, you know, the pendulum swung too far and it's now been all anti-men and, you know, women are getting too aggressive and assertive. But actually, unless the pendulum swings, you don't have that shift of attitudes. And it just sort of reminded me actually how important it is that sometimes, even if the pendulum sometimes swings a little bit too far to start with, that's a way of addressing a balance that needed to be redressed. And the way in which Monica Lewinsky was treated was really appalling compared to Bill Clinton in that situation. Although I think you're right, Libby, it's not all hunky-dory. You know, you think there are the different, you can't imagine a female prime minister with multiple children from multiple relationships not, you know, getting away with it in the way that Boris Johnson has. But, and even, you know, it's often his wife who gets criticized more than he does still over things. So there is still sexism, but the pendulum has swung, which is a good thing.
And there's also something about women and women, because, of course, the great betrayer of Monica Lewinsky was Linda Tripp, who secretly recorded a lot of phone calls where she sort of urged her to talk more about the Clinton affair, you know, and then gave them all to the prosecutors, the impeachment. I mean, Linda Tripp's behaviour was awful. Hillary Clinton referred to the poor sort of 22 to 24-year-old girl who'd had these 9 encounters with her husband as a narcissistic looney tune. You know, she just dismissed her, you know, rather than dismissing Bill, who she referred to, may we say, as just, he was always a hard dog to keep on the porch. Now, I think the great thing is no one's saying this now about people like Alex Salmond. You know, people are much harder on men now, and that's probably quite a good thing, much as I love men.
Time for a very quick touch on the story we were talking about a little earlier, the triple lock on pensions, the Institute for Government adding to the pressure on Rishi Sunak to scrap it because it would ensure a bumper increase in the state pension this year. Rachel, what do you make of this?
I think Rishi Sunak's desperate to scrap this triple lock, which is looking increasingly illogical. And you sort of have to remember the point about this triple lock was to make the situation fair for pensioners. But the problem is now, if pensioners get sort of 9% increases, which is what seems to be coming down the track if the lock stays in place, that's unfair to people of working age. So there's a sort of you know, wood for the trees thing here. This whole point was about fairness, and actually the danger is it's becoming unfair for people of working age. And there is going to have to be money raised, and this seems a completely obvious and natural way to do it. The problem is the Prime Minister who is worried about alienating his older Tory voters. But I think the Chancellor's just got to face him down.
Libby, there would undoubtedly be a lot of flack, political flack, for breaking a manifesto commitment. Do you think you should do it?
I think rather less flack than you would expect. I think that 9% would be outrageous. Why should it keep pace with everything, these triple values? It's atrocious. So speaking as a pensioner, I think the triple lock has to go. I'll tell you something else they could do something about, the deferral rule. I deferred my pension for 10 years, didn't draw a state pension for 10 years after I was entitled, simply because I didn't particularly need it. And now I discover, almost to my horror, that it's gone up considerably, and I now get about 1.25 times what my husband gets, or even more, who had his on time. And this just seems to me a desperately unfair thing. And they should put some work into that. I don't think there'd be nearly as much flack. I don't think elderly Tory voters are that obsessed with their own incomes. I think they would accept a much smaller increase.
I should say there's one who's not going to be too happy about it. Andrew's got in touch from Henfield. He says the state pension is not a state benefit. I paid into my state pension for 47 years. Leave the triple lock alone. That is what the Chancellor's going to have to contend with. That was Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. Up next, riding the populist wave.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
And now it's time for this.
Popular. I'll help you be popular. You'll hang
du mépris de classe, de la spoliation fiscale et de la déconnexion humaine d'un président dérangeant dans ses attitudes.
My mother and father signed up to a common market, not to a political union, not to flags, anthems, presidents, and now you even want your own army.
Todavía no, todavía no. Va a haber que trabajar mucho más. Pero habéis dado a Vox.
Diese Menschen arbeiten nicht. Ich sag, vernünftig.
Yes, we're talking about being popular, or actually rather populist. The noughties and 2020s have seen the mainstream right of political parties across Europe facing pressure from populist uprisings, whether it was UKIP and anti-European sentiment in Britain or the Vox Party in Spain. But what impact have they had on mainstream right-wing parties? Let's speak to Professor Tim Bale. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Just first of all, can we define what populism is? Because it's used in different ways, isn't it, by different people from different parts of the political spectrum?
That's a really good question, because as you say, it is a bit of a boo word for some people. They use it to label anything they don't particularly like as something bad. as far as academics are concerned, and I think actually the academic definition has kind of spread out beyond the ivory tower, as it were. When we're talking about populism, we're really talking about an approach to politics which tends to divide the people, if you like, on the one side, and on the other side, a corrupt elite that has somehow sold out the people, hasn't listened to it, has betrayed its interests. And pursued perhaps its own interests instead of the common interest. So it's that division, if you like, between the people on the one hand and the political class on the other that's the key characteristic, if you like, of populism. But there are also other things going on. Populist radical right parties tend to be quite nativist. In other words, they tend to say that politics should privilege those people who are born in the country, who are native to the country. And they also tend to have quite a kind of authoritarian turn as well. So they're very strong on law and order. They're very strict on immigration and those kinds of issues.
And where have we seen the most successful populist movements? I mean, I guess you could look at UKIP in the UK and the effect that party had on British politics more widely?
Well, UKIP is a really interesting example because, of course, our electoral system in the UK is not very permissive. In other words, we have first past the post, and most other European countries, aside from France, the biggest one, operate some kind of PR system which tends to allow smaller parties more room to breathe and more room to rise. But UKIP in some ways shows that you don't necessarily have to win seats in parliament to have an effect on the political system. If we look at other countries, however, we can see that in some countries, these populist radical right parties we're talking about have actually taken part in government. So they've been full coalition partners. The most obvious example would be Austria, where they've been in power two or three times, actually. There are other countries as well, Norway, Switzerland, Finland, Italy. So a whole range of countries, really, full members of the EU very often, where parties which are generally given a very, very bad press, particularly obviously in the liberal media in this country, have actually come into government. And then there are other places like Denmark, where they've not necessarily been fully part of the coalition, but they've supported a mainstream right party to govern. So they have been actually quite influential.
I mean, what about places like Hungary? And I mean, what happens when populists do get into power?
Well, Hungary is a really good example, and Poland is another example of another phenomenon that we've seen, where actually it's not the populist radical right, a small sort of insurgent party coming into power, but it's the mainstream right-wing party turning itself into, if you like, a kind of ersatz populist radical right party. So the party that currently governs Hungary, Fidesz, for example, started out as a kind of mainstream right-wing kind of liberal party, but has transmogrified, if you like, into a populist radical right party. And you could say the same of law and justice in Poland. And what we've seen there is a gradual erosion, and some people say it's not so very gradual, of liberal democracy. So we've seen attempts to try and limit the power of the judiciary, for example. We've seen the muzzling of the free press, particularly in Hungary. We've seen attempts, some people would argue, to rig the electoral system in favour of the mainstream right party, but now quite a populist radical right party. So there are some serious implications here for liberal democracy, some people would argue.
But what we've seen is that, for example, I mean, if you look at the EU, they've attempted to try and rein in some of the worst excesses of populist governments, like that in Hungary, in particular, their attacks on some basic rights. But once a party like that gets in power, it's then very difficult indeed to influence their behaviour.
But it is. I mean, the EU has actually rather kind of weak constraints on members. Once you've actually got into the EU, no one's ever actually been kicked out of the EU. There are attempts occasionally to use a kind of financial leverage to try and persuade countries to toe the line. And this might recently have had some effect in Poland. But it is very difficult for an external force like the EU, which, you know, doesn't have as much power perhaps as some Eurosceptics think it has, to actually affect what goes on in a sovereign state. And as you say, I mean, one of the problems in some ways when these parties take power or when they morph into a more kind of populist style of government is, of course, you know, they do change the electoral system to their advantage. They do change the media landscape to their advantage, which makes it even more difficult for the opposition to actually winkle them out of power. Now, of course, they're not necessarily there for forever. It may well be, and this is the case, some people think, in Hungary, that, you know, they will eventually run into problems. And there's a kind of gravity that operates in politics after all. But they can do a lot to insulate themselves from the kind of normal vicissitudes of day-to-day politics and therefore stay in power for quite a long time. However, I mean, I should say, I mean, one big example, of course, outside of Europe would be Donald Trump. What many people would see as a radical right-wing populist, you know, getting into power. Many people worried that somehow, you know, he would never leave. And some people would argue that what went on at the Capitol in early January was an example of him trying to hold on. But eventually, of course, he was winkled out of the White House and we have a new administration.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what is happening in an awful lot of different countries and indeed on how these populist movements affect the more mainstream right of politics. But in the United States, Donald Trump seems to have pretty much swept away all his Republican rivals. But in other parts, if you look especially at Europe, someone like President Macron appears to be constantly looking over his shoulder at his rivals to the right.
He does, and he's not untypical by any means. I mean, one of the things that we show in the book, and I should stress that, you know, I'm one of the editors of the book, so I've written parts of it, but we have, you know, contributions on individual countries by different authors. One of the things we see in terms of the mainstream right is, as you put it very nicely, actually, a kind of looking over their shoulder all the time at what the populist radical right or advocating and doing, and in some cases actually kind of co-opting and adopting the agenda, partly through fear that if they don't, they will lose voters to the populist radical right. Macron is quite an interesting one because he came through and completely disrupted the French system. The main centre-right force in France basically crumbled and he came through the middle. And he faced off against Marine Le Pen and the Front National. But since he's been in power, he said some actually quite, you know, some people would say quite nationalistic, quite authoritarian things in order perhaps to try and stave off the threat that Marine Le Pen and the Front National still present. And if you look at the other countries that we look at, and as you say, there's a whole series of European countries that we look at, you can see, particularly on immigration, a very, very clear move over the last decade or so, and some people would say longer in some countries, towards a much more restrictive policy, partly because those parties, those mainstream right parties, are very worried about losing the electorate to those radical right parties. They're also, it has to be said, of course, responding to a demand in the electorate for tighter immigration policies, you know, concern about the migration crisis that we saw in 2015 and one that might be repeated after the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban. So it is, you know, it's a European-wide phenomenon. But one of the other things that we stress in the book is that obviously there is a trade-off here because mainstream right parties also have to worry about a potential kind of backlash, as it were, to them moving to the right on some of those issues from other voters. So, you know, well-heeled, well-educated voters tend to be rather more liberal and have got more liberal over the years and actually can object to some of the more kind of, you know, nationalistic, authoritarian, anti-immigration politics that some mainstream right parties have adopted through fear of the radical right.
And I'm joined now by Amelia Hadfield, who's Professor of Politics at the University of Surrey. Hello, Amelia.
Hello, Carol.
And Matthew Goodwin, who is a politics professor at the University of Kent. Matthew, hello.
Hi, Carol.
Good to have you both with us. I know you've been listening to Tim Bale talking about his fascinating book. Amelia, let me just ask you, first of all, there was this time just a few years ago when Trump had stormed into the White House, when we had Brexit, when populism seemed to be riding a wave. Do you think it is still powerful, or has it ebbed somewhat since then?
Well, I think, as Tim has very nicely spelled out, it does mean different things to different places in Europe and different types of states. So populism is not quite perhaps the generic sort of catch-all method of government that we'd like to think it is. I think we've seen troughs and peaks. I think it just depends upon really who is sort of using it as a method of government. So you have people who are tremendously good at disrupting the system. Macron, in fact, himself was initially this disruptor. So was Nigel Farage. So was Trump. And either they stay a sort of intrinsic disruptor in terms of their modality, or as they get into power and begin to sort of shift the way in which they stay in power, there's a ongoing recalibration of what they want to do with those populist methods. I think the way in which Tim, in his book with his contributors, has spelled this out is very nice. He's really made a good distinction, I think, between far right parties and then populist parties, and then mainstream right parties. And I think we need to be careful, because there's an operative spectrum here, and sort of clubbing them all together isn't necessarily helpful. I also appreciated Tim's initial definition with regards to what populism is, because it's how strongly you believe in this that makes it likely to happen in your country. And that's the sort of people versus political class, the idea of the sort of host, if you like. We're the host nation, and people within it who struggle to find a place within it are they're an easy topic, if you like, and particularly an easy target. And if they're not well integrated, or show little signs of being interested in being integrated, then I think you have that gap into which populist antagonisms can really flow.
Interesting, we've had a tweet from Phil Waring. Can you seriously be listing the means by which Orban came to power, ignoring that the Tories have done exactly the same, he says. Matthew Goodwin, do you think that the Conservatives under Boris Johnson, I mean, would you describe them as a populist movement?
No, I wouldn't, actually. I think there's an increasing temptation, particularly on the left of politics, to brand everything and anybody that they don't like as populist, and I think that's incredibly unhelpful. I think the Conservative Party is a mainstream Conservative Party. I think it has certainly absorbed a large number of Nigel Farage's voters, but on many of the issues that the party is campaigning on, around a skill-based migration policy, around sovereignty, levelling up, the way in which it wants to use the state. These are all very mainstream positions. So I do think we need to be careful of the difference between them. And I think, if anything, just to perhaps be a little bit provocative in the conversation, I think, you know, when we talk about populism, we always typically talk about right-wing populism. And I think, actually, increasingly over the years ahead, we'll probably turn our attention back to left-wing populism. And in particular, I think we'll become more interested in the way in which the attitudes on the left of politics are rapidly changing. If you look at how Democrats have responded to Donald Trump, for example, you've seen a huge polarization in America as highly educated liberals have become even more liberal in their outlook, largely in response to Trump. And that is really aggravating the polarization that we have. And we've seen the same in Britain, with Remainers becoming much more positive about immigration after Brexit, becoming much more convinced in their ideological view. And I suspect that's where we'll end up in 5 or 10 years, is talking about the impact that this populist era has had on the left of politics, not just on the right.
Professor Tim Bale, we'll talk a little bit more about the left in a minute, but where does Boris Johnson, in your research and analysis of this, fit? Would you, I mean, he's not a classic populist in many ways, as Matthew has pointed out, but would you say that he sort of drew on some of those populist movements or some of their themes?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at his leadership of the Brexit campaign, in as much as he was the leader, I mean, clearly there was an attempt to pit, as it were, the between the people against the elites, and that was very effectively done. I think, you know, as Matthew says, you know, when we're talking about the Conservative Party, we are still talking, generally speaking, about a mainstream Conservative Party. But, you know, many people, many critics of the government, obviously, would point to some of the things that they're doing and point to some parallels, albeit in embryo, with what we've talked about already in Hungary and Poland, with regard, for example, to, you know, a kind of hostility towards judicial interference, as they would see it. Some people would talk about what they see as voter suppression when we talk about, you know, the voter ID bill, which is essentially getting rid of a problem that isn't really there. I mean, I don't think we're anywhere near in Britain a Conservative Party that is turning itself into Fidesz or Law and Justice. But there, you know, there are some elements there. Perhaps they are more performative than they are substantive. But, you know, there's always been a performative element in populism. And in some ways, that's one of its strengths. It doesn't necessarily tie the people who use it to particular policies. It's a useful rhetorical device, and it certainly has an appeal to some voters. But it also does create tensions, I think, with the Conservative Party. And I think, you know, immigration, which Matthew was talking about, is an interesting one there. And that's a challenge for all Conservative parties, actually, and centre-right parties across Europe. There is a tension between, on the one hand, this need to appeal to a kind of more nativist, nationalist take on immigration, and a more restrictive take on immigration, which is very, very popular, it has to be said, as Matthew has pointed out, on the one hand. And on the other, the fact that that perhaps has negative economic impacts, at least for the economy as a whole. And some people would argue that, you know, one of the problems with Brexit, particularly, you know, on the right, is it's not actually really a particularly kind of free market approach to the economy. It's a rather kind of protectionist approach, which perhaps sits ill with the Conservative Party's, you know, more traditional emphasis, at least since the 1980s anyway, on a much more free market kind of conservatism.
Amelia, I mean, Tim touched there on this question of migration and refugees. The EU is grappling with this even before the Afghanistan crisis. And there are a lot of concerns about large inflows of refugees. Do you think that that is likely to provide a further boost to these populist movements in elections we've got coming up, key ones in Germany, for example, later in the year?
Yes, it could well do. Bear in mind the migration crisis began in 2015 and then rumbled on for a few years afterwards, certainly had a huge impact in the way in which migration, immigration, security, borders, and topics like these, and the sort of securitization of that language was drawn upon by parties left and right, up and down the political spectrum. And I think if there's a sense that member states within the European Union and those beyond the European Union are being asked to step up and to support, if they can do it in a way that works nicely within their national interests and aligns with the ideological, you know, predispositions of their government, that's fine. But I think if they're feeling that they're being shoved into a corner and demanded, that's when there's a bit of a pushback. Tim was right, I think, when he talks a little bit about the rhetoric and the performativity aspect of populism. The problem is populism tends to concentrate, sometimes dangerously, the particular narratives that work. And then after an election or after a policy decision, it's very difficult to sort of walk that back, okay, particularly if you're working within sort of a series of interlocking institutions like the European Union. I think we need to bear in mind, though, that the profound humanitarian need, which is a very real issue, and a civil issue and a human rights issue that I do hope transcends some of the nativist and populist elements that tend to make up the rather more tribal makeup, if you like, of populism across Europe.
Lots of people getting in touch on Twitter. Hurry Up Henry says, strange to think that Johnson pit ordinary people against the elite. More honest to say that post the Brexit vote, the elite tried to overturn the popular vote. And someone's texted, the word populism is polite political nomenclature for racism and xenophobia. phobia. Matthew, is there an argument that says that perhaps populism just means politicians who are a little bit more in touch with what the voters actually want, and perhaps it shouldn't be painted or portrayed as such a dangerous idea?
Well, I think firstly there is a very distinctive tradition of populism. So I'm personally not of the view that being populist is just being popular. I think if you go all the way back to the 18th century, there's a long line of movements that are very distinctive in the style of politics that they use. But at the same time, I also agree with some of that sentiment, whereby we tend to talk about populism as though, for example, it is inherently anti-democratic, it is inherently ethnic nationalist, it wants citizenship to be restricted to, for example, white Britons, it wants to bring back the death penalty, it's highly authoritarian, etc., etc. Much of that is very misleading. Most populist movements in Europe have adapted themselves to democracy, albeit advocating a different conception of democracy. They advocate the original direct conception. They want to put the emphasis on the popular will, and they're less interested in the more procedural aspects of democracy. And most populist voters have adapted to the reality of our multicultural diverse societies. There are actually only minorities of populist voters in the UK, for example, who still cling to an exclusively heavily ethnic conception of who we are. So the problem we have is when we have these discussions and we sort of fall into these stereotypes and these very misleading narratives, we tend to aggravate the sort of alienation and disillusionment that many voters feel, because they look at academics like us talking about populism in a way that doesn't resonate with their everyday experience. And I do think that's part of the problem, the way that we talk about Boris Johnson, for example, and we throw around very crude comparisons between Boris Johnson and Viktor Orban, I don't think is helpful in terms of where we are. And it probably reflects the way in which the groups that dominate our conversation today are both culturally and geographically are very disconnected from the groups that are voting for these movements. I mean, we don't really have many non-graduate working class voices in media today. It's just not really something that we have, not only in Britain, but across much of the Western world. So the voices that are fueling these movements are often also simultaneously absent in much of our national conversation.
That's all from us. You can catch up with Matt on Times Radio Monday to Friday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.